Welcome to Learning from Nature, the Biomimicry Podcast with Lily Ehrman. I'm currently surviving the heat of a Denver summer without air conditioning, but we've made it so far. It's the season of walking by the river, backpacking in the mountains, and exploring every nook and cranny of this amazing place that I get to live. This episode will have you completely marveling at mushrooms. My guest Tamina will dive deep into what mushrooms are, why they are different colors, what the purpose of these colors are in nature, and explain how we can use these pigments in sustainable dyeing, artwork, and clothing. Tamina Curiel has experienced the kindness of nature since she was little, while growing up in the jungles of Southeast Mexico. From the first time that she observed how ecosystems were degrading, her love for all living things led her to nurture an infinite romance between biology and design at the ecosystem level. Tamina enjoys thinking not only in biomaterials, but also in designing companies that could work as a forest or a mangrove. Today, she's a biopreneur who manufactures bio-based inks for her fabric printing, an avid fungal pigments researcher, and a mushroom mom. Tamina learns from nature's intricacies and also uses nature directly in her designs. She forages for mushrooms and synthesizes colors to test on different fabrics. Her work is truly inspiring. Oh my goodness, you are going to absolutely love listening to this one. Also, a reminder for y'all that I have finally set up a Patreon account where you can support this podcast and contribute to its evolution. Join by searching Learning from Nature on Patreon and choosing your subscription level. This will ensure that I can keep the space ad-free, so I really appreciate it. Okay, let's scoot on into this conversation. So Tamina, welcome to Learning from Nature. I'd love for you to just start off by introducing yourself and include your pronouns, please.
Okay, well, thank you so much for inviting me, Lily. I'm a huge fan of yours. I love your videos. They make me laugh so much. And it's rare to introduce myself. well, I'm officially, I'm not a biologist or a mycologist. I'm a product designer. Mm-hmm. I have a bachelor in product design, and then I studied a master's degree in biomimicry at Arizona State University. So I'm weird because when I was in the last semester of my design studies, I found this thing called biomimicry, and I fell in love with the thing that is, I can nurture design with biology and the other way around. So I think that I'm some sort of mushroom because I've been evolving and going back and forward. And I'm really interested in color. Another thing is that I recently discovered I've been diagnosed with TDHD and mild autism. So it has been really fun to embracing this part of me that I knew there was something. Yeah. You always know, like, why am I so weird? There's no explanation. Well, now there is. And and the thing is that I have these neurodivergent tools in my brain that help me to be hyper-focused on research when it comes to color and fungal pigments and all the crazy things that I want to do.
Yeah, totally. And I feel you on the neurodivergence. I haven't been officially diagnosed, but I'm sure there's something in there that my brain works differently. And we embrace that here. It's like part of what makes us creative and unique humans.
Yay.
And learning about ourselves is a powerful tool for how we then express ourselves or do our research or do our work. So I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
No, thanks to you.
And so you mentioned your biomimicry master's degree, which, holla, I also have one. And that was a really fun experience. So I'd like for you to maybe share a little bit more of like what brought you to biomimicry in the first place. Like, what was your pathway into biomimicry? How did you first get interested in mushrooms? You mentioned a little bit of the product design, but kind of maybe just elaborating on that journey a little bit more.
Okay. So I'm Mexican. I live in Mexico. I was born in Mexico City, but at a very young age, we moved to Chiapas. So I grew up in Chiapas and Oaxaca, and I used to sneak around during lunchtime in elementary school and go down the river to collect moss, lichens, and to watch red mosquito larvae. So I'm sort of a Mowgli girl. I grew up among the jungles. So when I moved to Guadalajara, Jalisco, which is more a city kind of living, and I started to study design, I realized in one of my final semesters, the same semester that I found out about biomimicry, I was taking this subject about manufacturing processes. Metals, plastics, destruction, pollution, chaos, death. And I had a depression episode because I realized that the thing that I wanted to do was destroying the thing that I loved the most, which is nature. And every time that I went back to Chiapas or Oaxaca to visit my family and friends, I realized that pollution was real, that climate change was real, everything was changing, everything was becoming more and more awful. So after that slight depression episode, I came back and found out about biomimicry, and that was the enlightenment aha moment of my life, because I realized that we could work as designers along with nature, understand it, and not necessarily be fighting with it, because we are nature too. We are biodegradable, we are compostable. So it's just very stupid to think that you can go the opposite way. And that's when I had this professor, Dr. Giovanna Trotta. She's Italian and she has a PhD in biomimicry by the University of Torino. And she told me, well, there's a program, there's a master's degree. She told me about Janine Vinius. We traveled to South by South. What's the name of this festival in Austin?
Oh, yeah. South by Southwest Eco. I was there for the year they had the biomimicry content. I was there.
I was there too. Yeah, so I had the chance to meet Janine. I told her that I was in love with biomimicry. She said, welcome, do the master's degree. I enrolled. And as the final part, which is the virtual design lab, that is like a thesis that we do as designers in the biomimicry, I started to focus on pigments and color because, and this is like, I swear I'll try to make it brief. I'll get into it, because everybody asks, if you're a product designer, why are you making textile design and inks, and how did you end up like that? I was 27 years old. I had 109 students, designers. I started teaching at the university I graduated from while I was still studying the master's degree. Mm-hmm. And I just had a baby.
Oh, jeez.
So I was going crazy. A busy lady. Hallucinating. And I barely slept. I barely ate. I barely thought about anything at all. And the thing that I remember clearly, I was still breastfeeding. My son was 8 months old. And I thought, okay, I have to dress up like a university professor, even though I'm 27 and I look like as if I was 19. And I also have to be able to breastfeed my child. So how am I going to do this? And I have to find a way to do it. Anyway, I don't have time. So I just scrolled on Facebook and I found one of these cute clothing brands that are cheap, very cheap, suspiciously cheap. And I thought, okay, let's buy this thing. I cannot say the name, but I remember the name now. So I bought some dresses and some blouses that could be able to breastfeed with them and look fancy professor style. And when they arrived, the smell was awful. I felt dizzy. I felt nauseous. I felt really bad. And I thought, well, they are new. I have to wash them. I washed them 3 times and the smell didn't go away. So I could not breastfeed my child if I myself, an adult, a grown-up human, was feeling that bad just by smelling the fabric. Mm-hmm. So I started researching, you know, Elsevier, Sprinter, all night long. And I realized how carcinogenic are synthetic pigments that we use in the fashion industry. They pollute water. They pollute our cells. They create mutations in fish species. They are really, really a source of cancer and depletion for the ecosystem. So I was shocked. Another episode of depression. Very short one because I had no time to get depressed. And I talked to Michelle Feller. She was my instructor for the virtual design lab. Mm-hmm. And I told her, what am I going to do? She said, well, you cannot save the world by yourself. Start with one problem at a time. And that's when I bumped into mushrooms. When I started to research healthy ways, sustainable ways of extracting pigments from nature without harming nature and without harming ourselves.
Mm. That's a powerful pathway. I feel like it's really relatable for so many folks too, who are like, I found myself in this space of wanting to do more or like choose better options for mm-hmm. myself and my friends and family. And there's either not that much out there, or you're kind of weighing pros and cons of like what's least bad. Yes.
Precisely. Like,
yeah. And yeah, it's tricky. And so I value that. And to have that pathway bring you to this really cool area of fungal pigments. Mm-hmm. Let's get into that.
Yay!
So what are some of your favorite mushrooms to forage or use in your art as fungal pigments, and why?
Okay. I love geostrums, clathrus or red cage fungus, which is the common name of it, and dichromyces, which are the jellies fungus. They are abundant and funny to play with. Therefore, I forage them every now and then, and I keep them in the freezer because when I go to kindergarten and elementary schools, I bring them with me, and kids just love to squeeze them. When it comes to my art, I forage hypoxylons, anulohypoxylons, and aldinias. This type of ascomycetes are really abundant in my region, and they are really good for pigment research. They are one of the most powerful pigments you can find when it comes to mushrooms.
Hmm. And so maybe this question actually just came up as you were explaining this. Maybe we need to take a step back. What yes. is a mushroom?
Oh my God, what is a mushroom? I don't know. Nobody knows. Mushroom is the fruiting body of mycelium. True mushroom or true fungi is the mycelium structure, which is the vegetative part of the mushroom, sort of say. And these umbrellas, corals, and funny things that pop up from the soil are the reproductive organs. They are the ones responsible for spore dispersal. Some are edible, delicious, some are poisonous, some are deathly, and many of them are medicinal and have also mind-blowing properties. So it's composed by chitin, if that's the main polymer of the structure of the fungal cell. And they are different from us and different from plants because they have this property of being formed by chitin.
So they're not a plant and they're not an animal.
No, they're not a plant because they cannot photosynthesize. They are not animals because they do not have this type of proteins, the same that we have in our cells.
Right.
They do have protein, but they are different type of proteins.
This reminds me, this is a side tangent. There was a trending audio on Instagram that was like, living people eat dead mushrooms. Living mushrooms eat dead people.
And living mushrooms eat living people because they have them all over.
Weird. So weird.
Yes.
I love mushrooms, and I haven't really thought much about that kind of, they're this organism that inhabits so much of the planet in so many different ways. And they're oftentimes right under our feet and we don't know it.
Yes.
And then produce these wide range of fruiting bodies that have so many different uses and properties, both useful for us and other organisms that rely on them for food or shelter or whatever. And they're so cool, and they're everywhere, and we know so little about them.
Yes.
So I guess this leads me to my question around how you're interested in mushrooms. So what about mushroom pigments is interesting, and why are you using them in art, in your projects?
Okay. So I'm going to dive a little bit into some weird things right now.
Let's get into it.
I'll try to go slow.
Yes.
Okay, so when it comes to mushroom color, there is a why and there is a how. First, we have to be locally attuned and responsive to our environment. And unlike us humans, mushies cannot move from one place to another. Mm-hmm. So they have to detect changes in their environment and respond accordingly. So pigments are sort of the eyes of the mushrooms. They do not have specialized organs like we do, but they have photoreceptors within the fungal cells. Now, studies in species like Trichoderma, Neurospora crassa, and Aspergillus nidulans have shown that there are three main types of photoreceptors in fungi. These are cryptochromes, phytochromes, and opsin. They detect blue, red, and green wavelengths of light, respectively. So fungal pigments also perform many functions. They promote fungal growth, asexual and sexual. They promote resistance to abiotic stress factors like desiccation, extreme temperatures, and photooxidation. And they also enhance ecological interactions with neighbor species. That is the case of marine species like Fusarium and Periconia, which are filamentous fungi of the ocean. And it's a way of chemical signaling with sponges, corals, and other microbes. These two fungus, they give red and deep purple colors. Another thing is that in the case of lichens, the family Telochistaceae, it's believed to have the function of UV protection because the type of pigment they produce are anthocyanins. And these are crystalline structures that reflect the orange wavelengths of light. Now, the mycosymbiont is the one responsible not only for structure, but also for pigment productions. It's the case also of Usnea lichen, which has usnic acid, and it also has antifungal properties, which keeps the colony safe. So when it comes to strict biology, we could say that the evolutionary pressures led to this type of convergent evolution in fungal species, regardless of their genus, and that's why we find all sorts of colors in all sorts of fungi.
So there's a lot going on there. There's a lot happening. You mentioned the three different kinds of receptors. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Oh, yes. So photoreceptors are specialized molecules, and they are composed by proteins, and they also have a chromophore. The chromophore is the functional group of the molecule. This tiny part of it is responsible of triggering cellular responses within the fungal cell. Now, when the chromophore absorbs light, it changes the structure like it happens in other pigments in plants. And that gives room to biosynthetic pathways. There are many different types of biosynthetic processes, but the thing is that they are the result of the primary metabolism. That's why it's called secondary. That's why pigments are called secondary metabolites, because they are the consequence of primary metabolism. So these molecules, they light creates light because these photoreceptors absorb light, and then they create this cellular signaling within the cell. So what is really, really cool and crazy about them is that they also, not all photoreceptors are color molecules. So they absorb light, but they also trigger the cellular response of creating pigments that are visible to our eyes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So and if I go out and see a purple mushroom, is it always going to be, you know, the purple on the top of the mushroom that I see is, you know, a receptor like this or has a function like you mentioned?
The pigments we see that are colorful in the fruiting mushrooms, they are pigments produced after the photoreceptors send the signal of producing the pigment. It's like gossip. It's like a soap opera. You know, the cousin of my mother told my nephew that I told her when she saw me with the other neighbor. It's just like, it's like a Mexican novela drama.
Oh my God, I love that.
Yes. So that the fruiting bodies, there are intracellular and extracellular pigments. In the fruiting bodies, we can observe the extracellular pigments because they are somehow outside the cell and therefore they are soluble in water, like Lactarius, like other mushrooms that you can squeeze and you can extract color from them, like Cortinarius species, Pheolusionitiae. Many of the dye mushrooms are Basidiomycetes, and they are pigmented fruiting bodies because they have these functions of UV protection, of they attract insects for spore dispersal. Now, something really cool is that pigments, you have the photoreceptor, and the chromophore within this structure of proteins has a Venson ring, because a Venson ring is created by alternated double and single pi bonds. That's where the color magic happens. So when light hits this compound, it reacts. Then the mushroom creates the pigment that we observe and that we can touch. And these pigments are also composed by aromatic compounds, Venson rings. We can observe also this structure that is single and double alternated pi bonds within the chemical structure. And that's like an electron highway where color is happening. That's why we can see the color and why we can extract it and manipulate it.
Okay. So in summary.
Yes.
Or I'm trying to visualize. You can't see me, but I'm waving my hands around. The light hits a mushroom.
Yes.
There is a photoreceptor that receives that color, that wavelength of light. Uh-huh. And a trigger happens mm-hmm. within that receptor, and it creates then a pigment that is either on the outside or on the inside. And if it's on the outside, we can see it. And then that pigment has a purpose.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, the thing here is that light, you know, before the mycelium becomes a fruiting body, it has to receive signals. So how can mushrooms or how can fungi sense light if it's underground? And that's something that I get asked a lot.
Yeah.
So certain wavelengths of light are able to penetrate the soil. Moisture and particle size and particle color will also play an important role in the amount and type of wavelengths that are absorbed in the soil. Red and infrared wavelengths are the ones that go deeper, about 5 millimeters maximum. So when soil is water saturated, light absorption increases by a threefold. That's why rain is so important in many ways for mushrooms and for everything. So because the soil is water saturated, so it will absorb more light. That means the mycelium receives more and more signals, and that means more cellular activity. So is it time to grow? Is it time to fruit? Do I have to reproduce? Do I have to fight another microorganism? Do I have to attract insects for spore dispersal? Fungal pigments trigger and regulate all of these responses when they absorb light.
I had no idea. That is so cool. They can sense, there's signals that they can sense underground. That is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Your rooms are amazing. I love them.
It's like magic. I would have never thought that light, and this is from my, you know, pretty small experience as a human, my very limited perceptions, right?
Our very limited.
Yeah, it's like I would never guess that that would have been the signal, and then they can grow based on light and moisture, and those all play a key part even when they're underground.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Because different wavelengths are absorbed by different photoreceptors, and they have different biosynthetic pathways that lead to the formation of these compounds.
So when we say pigments for mushrooms, mm-hmm. what do you mean? Is it just like all the colors of the rainbow that we can sense or that we can see with our eyes? Is it, are there more colors that we see more often with mushrooms? Are there colors that are really rare? Can you just give an overview of like what kind of stuff we're seeing, what kind of stuff you're seeing in mushrooms as far as pigments go?
Yes. Well, there are many, 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 many colors and many hues, because the hue of a color depends on the size of the wavelengths. That's why we have soft pink, red pink, many mixtures of colors in everything, and it also happens in mushrooms. Mm-hmm. Now, the blue color is really rare. I don't know why, but you know this too because you are a biomimic. So it's really, 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 really rare. So we observe the blue stain in boletus, which is an oxidation reaction to the uricic acid it has within the cell. So when oxygen comes to the fruiting body, when you cut it, it oxidizes and you observe a deep blue. I guess there's not so much blue in nature because blue wavelengths play an important role in circadian rhythm in many organisms. So if everything around us was blue, we will be very disturbed. That's one of my hypotheses. However, when it comes to mushrooms, we can observe that orange colors are very common. Red colors are very common. Also deep black, brownish blacks, because some of these compounds are melanins, anthrocyanins, acephalones, and they, most of them function as UV protection. They have to protect from sunlight, because some wavelengths of sunlight can damage DNA. Mm-hmm. And some mushrooms, like Faolo shwanitzii, the Dyer's polypore, the main compound that you find in there, the fungal pigment, is ispidine. And now ispidine is a very funny molecule because it's fluorescent under UV light. So we can see colors, but there are other colors that we cannot see, but they are sending these signals to their environment. So insects and other types of organisms can detect these colors that we cannot do, like what happens with flowers and honeybees.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
This reminds me of bioluminescence too. If you're able to expand on why we know that we know some mushrooms can literally glow in the dark, which is insane to think about, why, like, what is the role of mushrooms being able to glow in the dark?
Well, nobody knows so far. Some say it's for spore dispersal to attract insects, but it's a lot of energy, you know, because it happens in a similar way with fireflies. It's a chemical reaction with an enzymatic process. Mm-hmm. It's luciferasa. I cannot recall the name in English. Probably it's the same luciferasa or something like that. It's the same chemical reaction when these two chemicals bump and burst and you see the color. I believe because there are some species in which mycelium glows and others mycelium is dull but fruiting bodies glow. And I will venture to say that it's a way of communicating within them, perhaps within the same organism and within other strains or types of mushrooms at the mycelium level. Of course, probably it also helps with the insect attraction thing, because many of those mushrooms are found to have many beetles and flies eating them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think it goes deeper, because it's much magic just to attract insects.
It's on my nature nerd bucket list to see bioluminescent fungi. That would be so cool. Have you seen any?
I saw one. The mycelium was glowing, not so hard, but it was so magical. The town of Nojbek in Quintana Roo. It's an hour drive of Chetumal by highway. And it was really magic. Now, in Jalapa, we have many species of mycenas that are still being classified that glow as well.
Oh, cool. Mushrooms. So cool. So I want to get into how you use pigments.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you share more about your work in fabrics and textiles and how you're using and learning from the mushrooms that you're experimenting with and then using those pigments in a kind of a life-friendly way in your work?
Yes, absolutely. So I've done some experiments with Basidium aesetis, like Cortinarius and Ferruginitiae, and there's a classic way of extracting pigments. You boil them, and Julie Biller is amazing at this. She has many workshops. She has thought about this. So you make like a mushroom soup, very soupy. You boil them for an hour and a half, and then you add alum, potash alum, and soda ash. And that will make that the pigment molecules that are floating in the water precipitate, forming a metallic salt. And then you have a concentrated, non-soluble pigment. After that, you can add a binder, water, Arabic gum, and create a painting or a paste. Now, in the case of hypoxylons, there's a funny thing, because stromata is the part of the mushroom. They're like crust fungi. And these stromata, when they are mature, they have the pigments. So you need to extract them, because it's really, the structure is quite hard. So you add potassium hydroxide at a 5% or 10% concentration. And that way you will extract the pigment. Now, nobody is doing hypoxylon pigment extraction at the industrial level, because hypoxylons are really, really hard to reproduce under laboratory conditions. No one has achieved that so far. And there's an amazing scientist called Max Stadler. He's from Germany. He's the one doing more research about hypoxylons, because they have these pigments, which are polyketides. A polyketide is a molecular compound that has bioactive properties, which means they can interact with human cells. They can go through the cell wall and deliver pharmaceuticals, for example. So they are doing a great research in this, and the problem is that they haven't been able to reproduce hypoxylons under laboratory conditions, because they are endophytes. So we still don't know what are the nutrients they take from plants to create these amazing pigments. So they create mycelium but they do not create a stromata. So stromata has to be submerged in potassium hydroxide solution. And then I use it, I add a binder like Arabic gum, and that way I can do the screen printing.
And so I love the work that you're putting out. I've been stalking you on Instagram. And how do you, like, what kind of stuff are you making with this dye?
Well, right now I'm just making a sample, a set of samples, because my research process is the following. I go out and forage what's abundant in my region, especially, well, hypoxylons are saprophytic, but are endophytic. They are weird like me, so we're okay. But I tend to focus on abundant species. So when I come back from these adventures, I try to ID the species. Once I find the name of the species, I research secondary literature regarding are they toxic for humans or not. And if they are not toxic, that's the first screening process. If they are not toxic, then I do the extraction of the pigment. If I find that they have pigments, I do the screen printing process. Once I have the fabric sample, I wait a week and then I wash it. I wash it and I rub it and I do everything to it. If it survives, then I do some research on how to grow them or how to make a proper environment, natural one, for them to grow. That's mm-hmm. the case of Daldinia. So far is the mushroom that I've been more successful with reproducing and using for screen printing. Other hypoxylons are amazing and they give green, deep olive colors, but they cannot be reproduced.
So you're actually figuring out how to grow these too.
Yes.
Whoa. How many mushrooms are you growing right now?
Just one tiny Daldinia.
Okay.
One petri dish of Daldinia. And it gave amazing deep black mycelium. I wasn't able to fruit it because I moved. So I had to pack all of my stuff. And with the heat, which is crazy here, it kind of died. But I'm thinking that probably we could have places where you only have the branches with the appropriate humidity and the appropriate temperature. And Daldinias here, they grow like apples. They're everywhere. Everywhere you can find them.
Can you explain a little bit how you grow mushrooms?
Well, mushrooms are very capricious. They are very, very hard to grow, some of them, because they have these, if not symbiotic, really important interactions with plants. So in the case of Daldinias and hypoxylons, we still don't think they have symbiotic relationships with plants. However, they do need to be inside them first in order to fruit. Mm. So when it comes to Daldinias and many Ascomycetes, it's really, really easy and really simple. If you have your PDA on your agar petri dish, the only thing you do is to splash it with spores or just a tiny part of the mushroom when it comes to Daldinia. I open the basidiocarp, which is this like little ball. I open it and part of this tissue, I put it there. I don't even add sugars, just the PDA, and it starts to grow and it starts to grow. Now, when you alter temperature, it will give room for the mycelium to form these fruiting bodies, small ones, because, you know, petri dishes are really small. And that's in the case of Daldinia, which is really, really simple. Sadly, Cortinarius, Phaeolochoanitia, and these dye mushrooms cannot be grown under laboratory conditions because they have symbiotic relationship with trees. So you will have to reproduce the whole forest, which will be amazing, but no one wants to do it.
Right. So when you go out and forage, are you foraging mostly just for pigments and your art, or are you also foraging for food?
Well, I forage for food every now and then because funny thing is that the place I live in, it's the Yucatan Peninsula, is the place where the meteorite hit Earth and killed all the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. So since it was under the ocean and it came out and it was a huge disaster, we have a karstic soil. So all the water from the rain goes back to the cenote system, which are these beautiful, mesmerizing,
deep blue,
natural pools that are interconnected and go back and to the ocean. So we do not retain moisture. The soil is basically just calcium stones. That's the soil we have. So they're very hard. Yeah, very hard. So I guess Basidio Maicetti said, okay, we're not welcome here. Let's go somewhere else. And it's really hard to find Basidio Maicetti in this place. That's why I moved here, because there are many, many, many ascomycetes, and some molds and filamentous fungi can be grown under laboratory conditions and are really bright in this part of the world.
Okay.
Now, when it comes to edibles, we have an endemic, beautiful and delicious species of Cantharellus, which is Cantharellus coccolobae. And it has a symbiotic relationship with coccoloba, which is called ocean or beach grape. Uva de mar, that's the name of this. It's a bush, actually. And the tzilzilche tree, which is a tree with tiny, tiny white flowers. And the native Melipona species of bees have this special relationship with the tree, because it's the most sacred and medicinal honey you could find. And this tree, the tzilzilche tree, also has a symbiotic relationship with Cantharellus. So September and October, I go everywhere to find Cantharellus coccolobae, because they are really delicious and they are rich in flavonoids.
I've been wanting to get into foraging, and it scares me, because there's a pretty big opportunity for error and a pretty big learning curve. So I think one of the big questions I have for you is, you know, I'm sure I have some folks, some listeners who are stoked about getting into foraging or learning more about mushrooms. How do you start that knowledge? How do you start building that knowledge and that confidence to go out and find mushrooms and then pick mushrooms and then potentially eat them?
And pray for your life. Well, I've always been crazy, but since I became a mom, I changed a lot. So I take more care of my life. And I'm also very nervous about it. Don't think that I go like, yeah, let's try that. No, I get really skittish, like the British will say. I get really nervous about it. So the first thing I did was to learn how to identify mushrooms. So I took an online course on taxonomy and, okay, let's know how to differentiate them, because they are really alike. Poisonous and edibles, they are really alike. So you have to train your eyes and look not only at the macroscopic features, but also at the microscopic level. If you have the chance, I mean, if you want to do it like, wow, deep, cool way, get a microscope or find a place where you can go, because spores are really different. And they might look the same, but when you look at the spores, you realize they're different species, and that could save your life. Now, the thing is that this Cantharellus madness that I have, I did it with a biologist friend. Not in presence, but I sent the pictures, I sent the measurements, I made the observation, and he told me, you can eat it, you will not die. And I ate just a tiny part of it. I waited, everything was okay, and then I ate all of those mushrooms. And last year, I went to Oaxaca, and I met Namas chef, Zachary Lowell, and his wife, Kim. And we went there to the mountains of Oaxaca with Alice Allen, mushroom color dye queen, who I love and admire. Okay, I worship her. And we ate what Zach harvested, because we were not sure about anything at all. There were many, many mushrooms. Now, there are species that are really, really hard to confuse with, which is Hypomyces lactiflorum. Is the lobster mushroom. And it's really, really easy to ID that one, because the scratch of the surface, the smell, the color, the shape it has, it's hard to get confused on that one. Also Lactarius indigo, which is this blue milk cap, and you cut it and it gives this blue, beautiful milk. And you cut it and everything is blue, so that's like a safe one to go. Cantharellus, the golden Cantharellus, are often misconfused with Omphalotus oleaceus, which is a dye mushroom, but it's poisonous. And so that's the one which you should take care of.
Avoid that one.
Avoid that one. And if you can just, also you can buy foraging guides.
Yeah, yeah.
So train your eyes. You really have to train your eyes because morphologically speaking, it might not be obvious, but when you start to differentiate between gills and wrinkles, it's like a game changer when you try to ID Cantharellus.
That's a good tip.
Yes. So your foraging guides, and get along with all mushroom heads in your region or far away. I mean, good thing is that mushroom people are good people. They can be trusted. And they're really open. So you can become a member of any mycological society. They are really, really welcoming. They're really cool. Humble Bay Mycological Society, they're really cool. Central Texas Mycological Society also. They're always welcoming new people, and you could go foraging with them and they will teach you, but only the experts are the ones who go foraging.
And it's a good advice too, that you mentioned, like, find the easy species that can't be confused with deadly poisonous ones. That's a tip that I like. It's like, okay, here are three or four species that I know in my area that they don't have lookalikes that are poisonous. Mm-hmm. That are probably easy to find, that are more common, because this is something I also want to mention. How do you forage sustainably? And I think if people go with the mycological societies and with experts, it's pretty obvious. Like, you know, you don't take everything in one area. Mm-hmm. And that's a good note too, to like go with those communities and those groups of people that have been doing it for decades and learn from them, learn from how they, you know, respect and honor the land and share and understand their knowledge and have them share what they know.
Oh, yes. Well, the first thing, in the US, I don't know. I believe there are some native populations that do have a relationship with mushrooms. I do not know, honestly. Mm-hmm. In the US, you can go with these mycological societies. In the case of Mexico, Latin America, Brazil, Chile, the best thing you can do is go with the native people. Go with them and learn how they do it, because as you mentioned, they honor the land and they know how to pluck the mushroom, how to disperse it. The main thing is that you should bring a basket, because that way spores will continue to fall into the soil and new mushrooms will grow. If you have a plastic bag, it will not be good, because the spores will remain within the plastic bag. So always use a basket, reach out to native populations or reach out to experts. And I don't know if there's like a rule of thumb or a ratio, but I tend to forage a third part of what I found. Not half, a third part or even less, just to have the mushroom to show it to the children, or in the case of Cantharellus, just to have a nice tribe of it. Because snails, beetles, fleas, ants, termites, there are many, many species that feed on mushrooms. Yeah. And that's something that I found here. And it's really lovely, because you found this mushroom that it's half destroyed, all squishy. And it's filled with different types of insects. And they are devouring it. And ants here are crazy about mushrooms. I have a video recording of ants eating a red cage fungus. They're chopping, 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 eating, 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 harvesting, harvesting, and another type of agaricus species that I'm not sure which one is it. So they are really nurturing the forest. They're a food source for many organisms.
And we got to let them do what they do.
Yeah.
Okay, my last question, which I think this will either take us to the end or maybe over. but I wanted to ask you what you're most excited about right now. And maybe as part of that or after that, if you have any upcoming projects to share or like stuff you're working on now that you'd like to share.
Well, I'm really excited about pigments. I have a friend that is coming over in September, and we're going to have like a little tiny laboratory experiment. She works with Trichoderma, and she's a specialist in filamentous fungi, because filamentous fungi are really tricky. You have to learn to ID the colony morphology, then do the microscopy, and sometimes it's even necessary to do the DNA extraction to really know what species this is, because filamentous fungi can produce really strong compounds, and they can be carcinogenic or they can be cytotoxic. Mm. That's the two sides. Those are the two sides of the coin. You either find a mushroom that has cytotoxic activity, and it could be an amazing cancer treatment, or you find one that will give you cancer. Yeah. That's really tricky.
Error is pretty small there.
Yes, I'm really excited about that. And another thing is that actually tomorrow morning I have a meeting with a person because, okay, so climate change is real. Finally, everybody's realizing it's real. And we have huge problems, not only about water, but only about food. So vulnerable communities in the Yucatan Peninsula and most native people around the world, especially in Latin America, are facing the problem that their crops are not living. Yeah. They are not withstanding the heat. We reach in the summer 45 degrees, 45 Celsius degrees in the shadow.
Whoa.
In the sun is 50, 55 degrees. So these, well, evolutionary pressures that we have put upon ourselves as a species are creating a huge disaster with a high, high social cost. So what I want to do here is to develop low technique protocols so communities can grow mushrooms. We've seen that happening in Africa with Josephine Nakagande. We've seen it happening in Brazil. There's lots of people doing it, but it hasn't been done here in Yucatan. And with the heat, every time crops suffer because they do not have enough water, or the water is contaminated because the industry of pork production here in Yucatan is huge. So pigs in their feces, they have high, awful amounts of copper, and that's polluting the soil and that's polluting the water, because all the water that comes from the rain filters to the cenote system and goes back to the ocean, and it's a never-ending story.
It's all connected.
All connected. So I really want to design this way of not only teaching them, but creating these community laboratories and community farms that can have a business structure so they can sell their mushrooms. It's not only about producing so they can eat, but only producing so they can sell these mushrooms. And since we have this endemic gourmet species of Cantharellus coccolobae, it's really interesting to find a way to grow them under natural conditions, under laboratory conditions. Perhaps that will happen. It's a bit tricky, but I have a friend that is doing the research in his PhD about how to grow Cantharellus coccolobae under laboratory conditions. And just imagine a community of Mayan native people that are growing their own endemic species, and they are commercializing it, and they are eating it, and they are learning about the land they own. So it's like a decolonization of economy and de-accommodation of economy, because most of the times economy is based on commodities, but science-based economies are stronger, more resilient. And that's something that I'm really excited about.
That's amazing. I've just been sitting here like nodding and smiling. The last couple of minutes. That's so cool. What an amazing project, and so important. We are going to have to figure out some pretty radical solutions moving forward to climate chaos, which is, I find, the best word to describe it. And then there's so many effects on so many communities. Often the communities that have the worst effects aren't the ones doing the damage, but they're the ones feeling it.
Absolutely.
And giving power and decolonizing, like you said, is going to be a really important step as we move forward and create a future that is life friendly and equitable. Having Earth Day just a couple years ago, or a couple days ago, where these huge companies are like commodifying based on this title of Earth Day. I have a lot of feelings around that. So it's like, let's make everyday Earth Day, and let's talk about and have conversations around building community and empowering people. And I've just, what you said really resonated with me.
Oh, yes. It's just that we forget we are biodegradable, and we forget that economy and money and everything, that's something that's not real. I mean, it's real, of course. I'm not crazy. But it's not real life. It's not right. The truth of what we are living here.
Right.
So all these imaginary structures like capitalism, like the economy, like what we have to do, like we have to perform, we have to be someone, they make us forget that we are flesh, mm-hmm. that we are blood, that we are cells. So what's the purpose of doing something? You will eventually die. So decentralized organizations that can make communities thrive in the near future are better than companies, because companies will eventually die and they need someone saying what is going to be done. So Let's just start to deconstruct those concepts and realize that we have, what, 80, 90, 100, 120 years being very optimistic.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe, if you eat mushrooms.
If you eat a bad mushroom.
Yeah. That. What are you going to do during your lifetime? I mean, What's really going to be important for you? And what's not only about the what you leave, but what you help to grow and build. It's not about leaving something static. It's about nurturing something.
Yeah. I just got goosebumps. it's like, what can sustain us and sustain our communities and sustain future generations in a way that's reciprocal for nature and us, because we are nature.
And they forget about it in their cars, wearing metal and plastic, surrounded by concrete.
Mm-hmm.
They forget that they are fleshy.
Yeah, totally. I feel like we really went full circle all around this conversation, which was really beautiful. But Ximena, thank you so much for joining me today and chatting. I had a really wonderful time just sitting here and learning from you. And yeah, I've been inspired to start my foraging journey and just to learn more about these wild organisms that are all around us.
Oh, thanks to you, Lily. I'm so glad you love mushrooms. Go ahead, go foragings. Go to the mycological societies, buy your foraging guides and get all over to it. Be careful. Don't forage by yourself. Go with an expert, please.
Yes, learn from the elders and the experts.
Yes, absolutely. But welcome to the mushroom world. We are a pleasure to have you here.
Here's a quote from Michael Pollan to take with you. Fungi constitute the most poorly understood and underappreciated kingdom of life on Earth. If that doesn't motivate you to go crawl around on the forest floor, I don't know what will. Until next time, stay curious.